Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
This video needs to be seen by the American public. It is beyond shilling.
Senator Mark Warner responds to watching the U.S. military strike a boat with two survivors on it. For Saturday, December 6th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Warner is calling for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign. We'll dig into the boat strikes and Hegseth's controversial media policy at the Pentagon with NPR's Tom Bowman.
Once you try to put the lid on people, either military or civilians or reporters, more people pop up and are willing to talk with you.
And we'll hear from Gaza, where students are desperately waiting for visas to continue their education elsewhere.
Our four-story house was bombed, and now my family is under the rubble.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The U.S. is planning to announce before the end of the year the leaders who will sit on a so-called Board of Peace chaired by President Trump. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports they'll be overseeing the next steps in Gaza's future.
A U.S. official tells NPR President Trump's team is pushing to move to the second phase of the fragile ceasefire in Gaza. He spoke anonymously because the announcement hasn't officially been made yet. The U.S. is also pushing for the creation of an international stabilization force comprised of Muslim and Arab forces to be deployed in Gaza early next year. But it's unclear which countries will join and what their role will be. Egypt's Foreign Minister Badr Abdelati said at the Doha Forum in Qatar that the force needs to be deployed as soon as possible.
We need international forces to be deployed alongside the so-called yellow line in order to verify and to monitor the upholding of the ceasefire.
He says the troops should act as a buffer between Hamas and Israeli forces still inside Gaza. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Qatar.
An NPR investigation finds that for-profit companies are charging military veterans up to $20,000 for help claiming their disability benefits. NPR's Kaylee Fox Shannon has more.
In the last decade, scores of companies have sprung up to help veterans navigate notoriously complex disability claims. NPR looked at one such company in Florida called Trajector Medical. The VA has sent Trajector two letters warning it may be violating a federal law that requires accreditation to help vets this way. But Trajector and dozens of other companies like it continue to operate. A former employee said the company uses aggressive debt collection practices to make millions off of vets each year. She didn't want to use her name for fear of retaliation.
I didn't know that I was going to be like a debt collector, like banging on people's doors, like, give me your money.
Trajector has denied wrongdoing and says its mission continues to be to help vets receive benefits. Kaylee Fox Shannon, NPR News.
Netflix is buying Warner Brothers Discovery. The streaming pioneer beat out other media giants for the legendary studio and Warner assets like HBO. The deal is valued at $82.7 billion. NPR's Mondalit El Barco says, though, not everyone's happy.
There is bipartisan concern about the deal. Utah Senator Mike Lee, he tweeted that there's sure to be an antitrust hearing. Another Republican, Kansas Senator Roger Marshall, he suggests the deal could hurt consumers and even Western society. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat, tweeted that the Netflix deal looks like an anti-monopoly nightmare. She said it'll create a massive media giant that would force consumers into higher prices and fewer choices.
NPR's Mondalit El Barco. This deal still needs regulatory approval. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Rachel Vasquez. West Coast health officials are bucking the latest move by the CDC in continuing to recommend that all newborns be offered the hepatitis B vaccine. KQED's Billy Cruz reports.
A CDC committee voted on Friday to end a long-standing recommendation to vaccinate all newborns against hepatitis B. Health officials in four states, California, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii, rebuked the move, saying it could lead to more people getting liver disease and liver cancer. The states issued their own recommendation as part of the West Coast Health Alliance, which was formed as a counterweight to federal vaccine guidance under the Trump administration. The CDC did not respond to a request for comment. I'm Billy Cruz, KQED News.
A group of Bay Area residents say they don't want the Trump administration to start a war with Venezuela. KQED's Juan Carlos Lara reports from a rally in San Francisco today.
With U.S. military vessels stationed near Venezuela and President Donald Trump threatening to attack alleged drug trafficking targets on Venezuelan soil, activists say they were compelled to mobilize. Fabian Fernandez is a local organizer and the son of a Venezuelan immigrant.
These are our taxpayer dollars that could be going towards food, education, housing, that are going towards an all-out war to enrich the billionaires of this country who want Venezuela's oil.
For their part, members of the Trump administration have insisted that this effort is meant to tackle drug trafficking originating in Venezuela, though many experts say most drugs in the U.S. are not coming through the Caribbean. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
And I'm Rachel Vasquez.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org. And support comes from you, the listeners of KQED. This week in KQED Science, you can learn about meteor showers, that massive moon, and even a chance to see Jupiter at its most striking. A look ahead to this winter's astronomical events. Check it out at kqed.org/science. Chilly weather continuing tomorrow and especially tonight with lots of low-hanging tule fog.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. There is no hotter seat in Washington this week than Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's. On Thursday, the Department of Defense's Inspector General released a report saying that Hegseth violated agency policy by using a messaging app, Signal, earlier this year to share highly sensitive military plans. The Watchdog report said that his use of the app could have put troops at risk ahead of U.S. military strikes in Yemen. On top of that, Congress is showing bipartisan interest in scrutinizing the secretary's role in boat strikes in the Caribbean, strikes that seem to be continuing even as there are real questions about their legality. Amid all of this, Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, is calling for Hegseth to resign. Senator Warner joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hey, Miles. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So talk me through why you think Secretary Hegseth should resign.
Well, first, this is not something new. I called for his resignation in the spring when the Signal fiasco happened. And then we have the actions of this week. The backstory on this strike that took place in early September, where a drug boat or alleged drug boat was struck. 11 people on the boat, 9 were immediately killed, 2 were left on. And then there was a second strike that included 3 separate sets of munitions. And this video needs to be seen by the American public. It is beyond chilling. And the fact that Hegseth, I believe, by this action has literally put American troops potentially in legal harm's way underneath the international rules about lawful conflict. I'm not drawing any conclusions here, because when you make the accusation about war crimes, that is a accusation once made cannot be retracted. But we are in those waters or in that area because, again, I think this constant careless, sloppy approach from Pete Hegseth.
Well, so you were in this briefing with Admiral Frank Bradley this week where you watched this video from September 2nd showing the second strike on this alleged drug boat that killed the boat's survivors. As you mentioned, this video has not been made public. Can you describe a little bit more what it showed?
This administration is all about trying to publicize its actions. Parts of the video of the initial strike were shown as Hegseth bragged about this in the aftermath. The fact that the whole video was not released at that point, the fact that I think, frankly, those of us in Congress didn't know that there was this second strike is really, really troubling. You know, I'm not going to tell what conclusions I drew, but, and this is why people need to see it, but beyond chilling, individuals that were clearly, in my mind at least, out of the fight, grasping on to the portion of the boat that was still floating, and the fact that the drugs were potentially still on the boat, which, by the way, they never even tried to interdict at all, you know, somehow justified this second strike. I don't know any reasonable person that would make the judgment that this was these were still active combatants.
Well, that's I'm struggling to follow a little bit, Senator, because you're saying you're not making a decisive decision on whether you feel like this strike was legal. But everything I'm hearing, the fact that these were defenseless people, that the ship was already damaged to the point where that it posed no immediate threat to the United States, and you're saying any reasonable person would probably think this was illegal. Do you feel like this strike was illegal?
Miles, once you make the claim about war crimes, and if proven, that not only reflects on Pete Hegseth and the Trump administration, it reflects on the admiral involved, it reflects on the status of American military, how we are viewed not only in this country, but in the world. And so I want to see the execution order. I want to hear the communications between the admiral who made the second strike decision. I want to have all that data point. Obviously, I'm very, very, very troubled, and you know, I'm trying to hold back my final judgment. But as you indicate, this is a very chilling video.
I want to ask big picture about Secretary Hegseth's future at the Department of Defense, because following the Inspector General's report about his communications on Signal, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt kind of echoed his defenses that no classified information was leaked, that operational security was not compromised, and that kind of indicates that the president is still standing with the secretary. Do you have any sense of whether any of this has changed his standing within the administration?
Well, let's just deal with what Hegseth and the press secretary said. It's just not factually true. There would have been no problem at all if this original information wasn't classified. You wouldn't have anything classified in the document if it wasn't classified. So the idea there's no harm here, no foul, just not factually true.
What comes next when it comes to congressional oversight, specifically of the attacks on the boats in the Caribbean?
I believe we need the legal opinion. Congress has been able to read it. I think the public ought to read it. I think the video, the entire video, ought to be shown not only to Congress, but the American public. And it's at the end of the day, I don't believe we would have had this if we'd had a Secretary of Defense that had experience, competency, and leadership, and frankly, showed basic respect to our military and the professionalism of our military.
That's Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia. Thanks, Senator, for joining us.
Thank you, Miles.
The top vaccine advisory committee for the federal government voted yesterday to change its recommendation for the hepatitis B vaccine. This is a historic change from the current recommendation, which has been in place for decades, for newborns to receive 3 shots, including 1 at birth. The new recommendation will be for the hepatitis B vaccine only to be given at birth to infants born to women who test positive for the virus or whose infection status is unknown. This comes after a heated debate on Thursday that delayed the vote. The hepatitis B virus attacks the liver, and it has no cure. It can be especially serious for people who get infected as infants. The Hepatitis B Foundation released a statement on Thursday describing the meetings as lacking in transparency and one-sided. And we have the foundation's president, Dr. Sherry Cohen, with us now. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
So I really just want to start with this latest vote. What do you make of the committee's decision?
I don't understand the committee's decision. There's no new evidence or no new data to suggest any changes to the universal hepatitis B vaccine recommendation. There's certainly no evidence to consider going down from a 3-dose vaccine recommendation to potentially a 1-dose vaccine.
So let's walk through a little bit of the committee's recommendations here. They're voting to recommend testing children's antibody levels after each hepatitis B vaccine shot to determine whether additional doses are needed. Is it possible that 1 or 2 doses will do the trick and that maybe the 3 aren't necessary?
No, we have very strong data coming out of Alaska and clinical trials in other countries as well that checking titers is not a useful indicator of long-term protection. So there's really no utility there. What we do know is that all 3 doses are needed for long-term immunity. After the first dose, about 25% of healthy infants will develop immunity. And that percentage goes up to about 95 to 97% after the 3rd dose. But I just want to restate that the 3rd dose is needed for long-term, lifelong protection.
Talk to me a little bit about what we know about how the vaccine has impacted hepatitis B broadly since it's been in existence.
The hepatitis B vaccine is instrumental in decreasing the cases of hepatitis B that we have seen both in the U.S. and globally. In the last 40 years, we have been giving universal hepatitis B vaccine to every baby born in the U.S., and we have seen a 99% decrease in infections among infants and children in the U.S. And to me, that's one of the biggest wins in modern public health history.
What other outcomes, I guess, are you expecting from this decision beyond potential infection risk if less babies are vaccinated? Are there other costs specifically or consequences that could come from this decision?
There was a modeling study done that just was published last week, I think, that shows how many new infections that this would lead to. And we know that delaying the birth dose to 2 months will lead to at least a few thousand new infections a year, a few hundred cases, at least 500 cases of liver cancer a year, and an annual healthcare cost of an additional $222 million a year.
In your view, Dr. Cohen, are there aspects of the way the United States gives guidance about vaccines that do need reform, or is this really just skepticism for skepticism's sake?
I think that it's important to continue to always do scientifically rigorous review of recommendations. And I want to state that for the past number of years, ACIP and CDC have done that. We do actually re-review recommendations when it's necessary. Right now, we have a situation where changes were made for what we can only see is no established scientific or clinical basis. So I certainly think it's going to have implications for hepatitis B coverage for the next generation.
What do you tell, like, family and friends if they ask you, I'm a little confused about this guidance. Should I give my newborn the hepatitis B vaccine?
I would say I'm glad they asked, and I think it's important for every parent to know what is going in their kids' bodies. I asked. I had a little girl in the hospital 23 years ago, and I was working in the hepatitis B space, and I asked questions about the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. So I'm glad they're asking, and I would say go to trusted sources of information. And right now, for me, I would go to the American Academy of Pediatrics. I would go to the CHOP Vaccine Education Center. I would go to the Hepatitis B Foundation and talk to your provider and make sure your provider is also using the most scientifically rigorous trusted sources of information.
That's Dr. Sherry Cohen of the Hepatitis B Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. And Cal Privacy, enforcing privacy regulations and protecting consumer rights. Californians can take control of their personal information by opting out of selling and sharing it with businesses. More information at privacy.ca.gov. Maybe you can go for that. And the Moth Radio Hour is coming up at 8 o'clock this evening. You can also catch it Sunday mornings at 11, stories of chance meetings, unexpected connections, and pleasant surprises at Macy's while camping and in a graveyard. That's the Moth Radio Hour tonight at 8 and tomorrow morning at 11 on KQED News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Ukrainian and American delegates met for a third day in Miami today on finding a way to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff says they're making progress in the negotiations. This as Russia attacked Ukraine's energy facilities with drones and missiles overnight.
A mass shooting at an unlicensed bar in Pretoria, South Africa, killed at least 11 people today, including 3 children. Several other people were wounded. Police are looking for 3 suspects. And rideshare company Waymo says it will file a voluntary software recall after several reports that its self-driving cars illegally passed stopped school buses. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Coming up in the next segment of All Things Considered, a Stanford professor talks about the significance of Putin's visit to India. Support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members, especially our sustaining members of KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. For nearly 30 years, NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman has covered the U.S. military. When not in the field talking to officers or troops, he would regularly do most of his reporting at the Pentagon itself, roaming the halls of the sprawling building, attending briefings, and speaking to officials both on and off the record. That is, until this fall, when his access to the Pentagon was cut off. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said anyone covering the military would have to sign a pledge. Here's how Tom put it.
It basically says you can't solicit information if you're a reporter from Pentagon officials. You basically have to wait until they release information, then you can report on it.
Like most other media organizations, no one from NPR signed the pledge. Tom says he didn't even consider it.
Basically, it's telling us you can't be reporters. You have to be state media. Those that are now in the Pentagon are conspiracy theorists, far-right media. A lot of them aren't even reporters.
When we sat down earlier this week, Tom told me about a very specific moment he had around the time he turned in his press pass.
I was at a reception, and this guy walks up to me and he introduces himself, and he was a Chinese military attaché. And this guy says, "Tell me about this Pentagon policy." And I explain, just like I said to you, well, it says we can't solicit information. We have to wait until the military releases information. Then we're allowed to report on it. He said, "Oh, just like us."
So for this week's Reporter's Notebook, with the military so much in the news, I asked Tom if he was missing out on scoops because of this new policy.
No, I wouldn't say that. And I think my colleagues are doing an even better job getting scoops. And one of the reasons is, and I saw this under Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, once you try to put the lid on people, either military or civilians or reporters, more people pop up and are willing to talk with you.
Right, and it almost seems like the policy is backfiring in some way, and that it's motivating a lot of people who maybe wouldn't have talked if there wasn't such a sort of draconian policy about it.
And, you know, Hegseth and his friends basically say, oh, you're going into classified areas. That's completely untrue. We're not allowed in those places. We walk around the hallways talking with people. And a lot of times, Miles, it's just for direction. You could go up to a general or an admiral and say, hey, listen, I'm hearing this. Is this true? And he'll say, well, Tom, you have it half right. It's not really true. So it's helping us as reporters. It's also helping the military to make sure we get the stories right. And now one guy I talked with at the Pentagon said, the problem now is if somebody gets it completely wrong, we can't get a handle on that story because you guys aren't in the building. We can't go up to you in the press area and say, hey, listen, that story's not right. Don't repeat what you're hearing on X, you know.
That makes a lot of sense. Access in a lot of ways is just as advantageous to the source as it is to the media outlet. Totally.
Absolutely.
I want to help people understand. You're somebody who's covered this for a long time. There are a lot of stories about the military right now people are trying to track and make sense of. There is the ongoing military buildup in the Caribbean. There is the buildup of National Guard troops in the nation's capital. I guess I want to ask you big picture, all of these disparate threads, are there bigger picture takeaways, I guess, as you think about covering the second Trump administration and the military that you're taking from a number of these stories?
Well, I think one of the things is clearly the Trump administration is leaning forward, using the military in ways that had not been used in the past. I think, you know, sending all these National Guard troops to the streets. you know, this is a police job. It's not a National Guard job. And I think some people in Washington may say, listen, I'm glad the National Guard's in my neighborhood, particularly higher crime areas in D.C. But a lot of them, you know, they're walking around the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument. They're walking through Georgetown. There's not a lot of crime in these areas. What's going on in the Caribbean, they still haven't explained exactly what's going on here. They've now taken out 21 drug boats, of course, much of it, if not all of it, with cocaine. Some of those boats, I'm told, were heading to Europe or Africa, not even to the United States. So why are you doing this in the first place? And is this about really going after drugs and the cartels, or is this trying to get rid of President Maduro in Venezuela? No one is getting an explanation, not the Hill or not the American people, about where this thing is going.
Now that you don't have a press pass in the Pentagon, how are you getting information about these sort of these strikes happening in international waters? Obviously, you're not there. You're not at the Pentagon physically. Can you walk listeners through how information about some of this stuff is coming to you?
No, we're still talking to military officials, many active duty, some in the retired community that keep in touch with their former, you know, colleagues. People on the Hill we talk with as well. Also, I'm reaching more out to the embassies. Mm. Who would find out what's going on, let's say, with Ukraine, or in some cases, you know, like what's going on in the Caribbean. So, you know, we have to find workarounds, I think, to find out what's going on. So the information is getting out there. We're going to find a way to get the information for the American people, period.
What are the big questions you still have, specifically focusing on what's happening in the Caribbean right now, that we don't have answers to?
Well, again, I think, what is the overall policy? Are you trying to go after the cartels? If you're trying to do that, you're not going to do it by blowing away a couple of dozen boats. Are you going to start hitting land targets for cartels in Venezuela and elsewhere? And again, if you're going to take out the Maduro government, then, you know, the American people have to have a sense of what your plan is, what you're going to do, if you're going to overthrow a regime. Now, President Trump said he's spoken with Maduro. Well, are you trying to get him to leave on his own? What's going on behind the scenes? I mean, those are the questions.
Well, let me pivot to the other big story that we're all tracking here, which is the National Guard story, specifically the shooting in Washington, D.C. of two National Guard members from West Virginia. Tell me a little bit about your reporting on that story and kind of the outstanding questions that you're thinking about.
Well, I went down to the site. I got within a block of the shooting site, maybe an hour and a half after it happened. Spoke with two young women, Emma McDonald and Layla Christopher from Northern Virginia, who were just coming out of the metro moments after it happened. Here's Layla.
And then we like came up to the street, and a National Guards person told us to like run.
And they told us they went into a bakery next door. People were really afraid. And they said, you know, they saw an ambulance pull up. Emma said she looked out and saw this.
The National Guard member was covered in blood.
You know, after that, you know, we were reaching out to people and sources of mine and trying to find out what happened. And Kristi Noem.
That's Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem.
Basically said that this shooter was radicalized at his community in Bellingham, Washington, his Afghan community, without offering any evidence that that's the case. And my colleague Brian Mann has spoken with a volunteer who worked resettlement for the Afghans, who dealt with this guy's family, and said his mental health was clearly deteriorating over the past couple of years. And, you know, he would sit in his darkened room. He wouldn't come out for hours. He would drive around the country to Illinois, to Arizona. He wasn't able to keep a job. So it could be more PTSD as opposed to some radicalization. I know this particular guy, this alleged shooter, worked for the CIA in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. I spent a lot of time there around the time he was working with the CIA. He was part of this group called Zero Unit that worked going after senior Taliban leaders. They would do night raids in heavy combat. And frankly, the Human Rights Watch said some of these groups were involved in illegal killings and in torture. He has spoken to apparently a friend or a colleague who said that he was really troubled by what he went through in Afghanistan.
How long have you been covering the military now, Tom?
28 years.
Is all of this unprecedented to you, or do you have any comparisons in your career?
No, I think it's unprecedented. And again, you know, back in the day, we would have had background briefings, on-the-record briefings, you know, in the Pentagon explaining what they were doing and why they were doing it. But we don't have that anymore.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
In Gaza, every university and college has been destroyed or heavily damaged by Israeli military strikes during the war. Some students have managed to continue their education abroad, but many of those trying to get to Canada say their visa applications have been held up. And, as UK-based Palestinian reporter Abu Bakr Bashir tells us, some students have lost their lives while waiting for those visas.
Hello, my name is Dalia Ghazabed.
My name is Sally Abed, and I'm a mechanics engineer based in Gaza.
Dalia and Sally Abed, 26-year-old twin sisters, recorded these audio messages when they applied for advanced studies abroad. Dalia spoke of her skills.
In terms of technical skills, I'm well-versed in language like Python, Java, and C.
Sally was really excited.
Thank you for taking the time to learn about me. Thanks.
After the Gaza war began, they both got a full scholarship to study mechatronics engineering at the University of Waterloo in Canada. It is a field that combines mechanical and electrical engineering and robotics. The twins were in their room in northern Gaza last year, studying on their own when two tank shells hit their building, says their father Ghazi Abed.
The first shell killed Dalia, Sally, their mother, and two more of their siblings. The others were killed by the second shell.
Dalia and Sally Abed were still waiting for their Canadian student visas when they were killed. Another student, 27-year-old Sakhir Youssef, was also accepted to a study program in Canada and lost his entire family while waiting for his visa.
Our four-story house was bombed, and now my family is under the rubble.
Just applying to study abroad is a struggle for Gaza students, according to Caitlin Proctor, a political anthropologist who researches forced migration of young people in the Middle East.
Writing applications, taking interviews and entry tests from tents while displaced from their homes, often with very weak internet and even under bombardment.
More than 80 students in Gaza were given full scholarships to attend master's and PhD programs in Canada during the war, and they are still waiting for visas. That is according to a group called Palestinian Students and Scholars at Risk, or PSSAR. Nada El-Fallo, the group's director of student services, blames the Canadian authorities for holding up their visas.
It's very, very clearly discriminatory against the Palestinian students. And I believe that it is Canada's decision and Canada's lack of political will to help these students and to fix the process.
She told NPR a special Canadian security check has been applied to Gaza students with no time frame given for when it will be completed. Many students have been waiting for a visa for over a year and have no idea how many more months they may have to wait.
The point at which they're stuck at is the background check, which is a complete black box. So we do not know what happens in there.
The Canadian government's immigration agency told NPR in a statement it is aware of the increased processing times applications take, but denied that the screening was discriminatory. It said it is difficult to facilitate students' exit from Gaza and that once they do leave Gaza, biometrics requirements needed for a visa can be taken care of in neighboring countries like Egypt. But one student who did manage to leave Gaza for Egypt a year and a half ago still hasn't received his Canadian visa. Ala Hussein told NPR.
I have passed, of course, all steps like biometrics and eligibility check and other all of that is done and passed. Just waiting all of this period just to stuck in the background check.
Gaza students and academics say, in contrast to Canada, France, Ireland and the UK have relaxed their visa rules. The Irish government says it has welcomed 200 students from Gaza during the war. In recent months, 78 students have arrived in the UK from Gaza. Around 20 more are due soon, said Nora Parr, a research fellow at Birmingham University. In total, Only a few hundred students have made it to international universities outside Gaza. Proctor, the political anthropologist, says these students are vital for the future of the Palestinian territory.
These are the young people who are going to become future leaders in Palestine.
Tens of thousands of other young college students remain in Gaza, not attending school or doing the bare minimum of studying online with other Palestinian universities. They are doing this on their own, in a tent, or amid the rubble of their destroyed homes. For NPR, I am Abu Bakr Bashir.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Russian President Vladimir Putin was in New Delhi this week for a summit with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. It was Putin's first visit to India since the war in Ukraine started, and the talks come at a time when Washington has been pressuring Indian companies to avoid buying Russian oil if they want to continue doing business in the United States. In August, President Trump imposed 50% tariffs on most Indian products, arguing that Delhi's purchases of Russian oil have helped fund the war in Ukraine. Prime Minister Modi now faces a tough balancing act between India's strategic ties with Moscow, India's biggest arms supplier, and managing trade tensions with the United States, which is the country's largest commercial partner. For more on this visit, let's bring in Shamit Ganguly, who leads the Huntington Program on Strengthening U.S.-India Relations at Stanford University. Professor Ganguly, welcome.
Thank you for this opportunity.
So talk me through a little bit about what Putin's visit to India, what message does this send? What is your takeaway here?
Putin needs India, and India needs Putin, at least at the present moment. Putin is going to India largely because he finds himself isolated in the world, particularly with the Western world, and India, in turn, in large part is acting out of a peak because of the rift that has emerged between India and the United States because of President Trump's draconian tariffs of 50% on India, in part because of India's purchase of Russian oil, and also Trump's irritation that India refused to publicly acknowledge the putative role that Trump played in settling a recent skirmish between India and Pakistan, and India has maintained a stony silence on that subject.
It feels like India is trying to balance this relationship between Russia and the United States. That it feels like a difficult thing to do. Does India have to pick a side here, or can they keep walking this tightrope?
Well, India is insisting that it can pursue the strategy of what India calls multi-alignment, that we are not going to be friends with one particular country at the cost of friendship with another. And I'm not sure that India can pursue this indefinitely, and particularly since Putin's view of India is entirely transactional.
Where do you think the future of the U.S.-India relationship is headed, I guess? Can you forecast it a little bit for us?
The U.S. and India have a viable working relationship now, which has enjoyed bipartisan support over the last 2 to 3 decades. The relationship is built upon a significant Indian diaspora in the United States, who have been remarkably successful. Over the last 20 years, India has purchased over $20 billion worth of military equipment. Despite the turbulence and the difficulties it is encountering at the moment because of the differences between Trump and Modi, I do not see this relationship becoming a completely sterile one in the foreseeable future.
That's Professor Shumit Ganguly of the Hoover Institution of Stanford University. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, the White House insulted Sabrina Carpenter and Franklin the Turtle, but despite our best efforts, not us. Join us for the apparently insufficiently provocative news quiz from NPR.
Wait, don't tell me. It's coming up in about 20 minutes at 6 o'clock. This American Life at 7, stories about people who find themselves in the middle of something much bigger than themselves, but situations they did not create, but which they cannot ignore. This American Life at 7.
Hey, I'm Sam Sanders, and I'm happy to say that I am back in the Bay. The Sam Sanders Show is coming to KQED on Sunday afternoons. I'll keep you up to date on culture, talk with the people shaping today, and bring a little bit of joy to start your week. From big ideas to good laughs, the Sam Sanders Show is just the conversation you need to wrap your weekend. Join me starting December 7th here on 88.5.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 3 on KQED News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The San Diego City Attorney's Office has agreed to pay $30 million to the family of a black 16-year-old who was fatally shot by police last January. If approved, it would be one of the largest settlements of a police-involved killing case in U.S. history. The National Park Service says it's revising its list of the days that people can visit the parks for free. It's kept many, but it dropped Martin Luther King Jr. Day and Juneteenth while adding a new free day, June 14th, Flag Day, which is also President Trump's birthday. And parts of the Tower of London was closed today after protesters smeared apple crumble and yellow custard on a display case containing the imperial state crown. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. And Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X, what's in your wallet, terms apply, details at CapitalOne.com. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. We have a coastal flood advisory in effect until tomorrow afternoon. Chilly temperatures tonight and lots of clouds and some hazy sunshine expected tomorrow.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. It's been 10 days since two National Guard soldiers from West Virginia were shot in Washington, D.C. 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom died on Thanksgiving, but West Virginia's governor indicated last night that the other victim, 24-year-old Andrew Wolf, is slowly healing. NPR's Scott Newman traveled to West Virginia, and he brings us this story about a state where many see joining the military as a duty, and in some cases, an economic necessity.
Traveling the country roads through West Virginia, a few things stand out. Of course, the stunning mountain vistas and rivers, but also the bridges. All of them are seemingly named after military veterans. Banners on telephone and light posts line main streets in small towns. They feature hometown soldiers, many who fought and died in America's wars. John Hardy is a commissioner in Berkeley County in the state's eastern panhandle.
You know, West Virginia has a very high per capita of veterans versus other states. So, you know, we've had a lot of people from West Virginia that have served in the military and all the branches. And, you know, some have paid the ultimate sacrifice.
Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom paid that ultimate sacrifice. But it wasn't fighting in any foreign war. A gunman opened fire on her just blocks from the White House. She was on patrol as part of President Trump's controversial deployments in U.S. cities. Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf was also wounded. He remains in serious condition. With its military tradition, the tragedy has hit hard for West Virginia. Beckstrom was just a few years out of high school. Charity Powers is a guidance counselor at Martinsburg High School. She says a lot of young adults are looking at ways to fund college or trade school, and the Guard is there for them.
But I think in this area, especially for kids who are kind of disadvantaged, which we have a lot of those students, it's a really good opportunity for them.
Air Force Staff Sergeant Jason Mitchell is from the same unit as Wolf, but instead of going to Washington, he's just returned from the Middle East as part of a rotating deployment.
I went to college, did the whole college thing, and then, you know, got a degree, and it was like, well, what do I do now? And my stepdaughter actually just joined, and she graduated basic while I was deployed.
At a restaurant in downtown Martinsburg, James Morris is having breakfast with a friend. He proudly sports a Vietnam veteran cap. He served as a Navy corpsman on a hospital ship during the Tet Offensive. One of his sons joined the Guard, and the other the regular army.
People join the Guard for many reasons. A lot of them join because they like the benefits that they get, but they do it too because they want to provide a service to their state and their federal government.
At a prayer vigil for Wolf in Martinsburg, his father, Jason Wolf, a patrol sergeant with the Berkeley County Sheriff's Department, struggles to talk about his son.
It's the worst thing that could happen to anyone's family member in this world. I wouldn't want any of you to have to go through this.
Berkeley County Sheriff Rob Blair says the National Guard is like connective tissue in communities like Martinsburg.
When there's a natural disaster or any emergency, that's who we turn to.
As West Virginia prays for one soldier and mourns another, a community shaped by the Guard stands by its own. Scott Newman, NPR News, Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Last week, protesters in Tbilisi, the capital of the Republic of Georgia, on Russia's southern border, marked 365 days of nonstop protests. They say their government is crushing democracy and the hopes of joining the European Union in favor of closer ties with Russia, which to this day continues to have troops occupying two breakaway regions in the country. Here's Robin Forestier Walker's report, and just a warning, this story starts with the sounds of fireworks.
It is November 2024, and protesters are facing down tear gas and water cannons on Tbilisi's main avenue. They set off fireworks and flash lasers in the direction of black-clad riot police. On November 28th last year, the Prime Minister, Irakli Kobakhidze, announced that Georgia would halt European integration for 4 years. For the thousands of Georgians who thronged the streets that night and for weeks to come, his speech was considered a goodwill gesture to Russia and an insult to their dream of joining the European Union. Nodalat Sabidze is a protester.
Our government, they have Russian friends, and they are helping them, like putting lots of money and lots of power here against us.
This past year, the government has been crushing dissent, with beatings and arrests, the jailing of opposition leaders, big fines for protesters, and the criminalization of Western-funded NGOs and the media. Now it's restructuring the universities like this one. Students, the backbone of the protest movement, are the ultimate target, says Georgi Kvalia, vice rector of Ilya State University.
They find it probably very unpleasant that students, really go against their official narrative. I believe that they really use this term reform to conceal their underlying motivation, that is to strengthen the state and political control over the universities.
This month, the European Commission, based in Brussels, concluded that Georgia's democratic backsliding made it a candidate for EU membership in name only. In response, the government accuses the EU of liberal elitism, out of touch with an emerging new Europe. Shalva Papuashvili is the Speaker of Parliament.
Brussels has strayed from European values. We see them attacking Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and the number of patriotic forces in these countries and others is growing in Germany and France and elsewhere. The time will come when Brussels will have to account for all of this. Brussels is anti-European, not us.
European institutions have sided with the protesters. The European Parliament awarded its prestigious Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought to Mzia Amaglobeli, who founded two independent media outlets. She's serving a 2-year prison sentence for slapping a police officer. Fellow journalist Tamar Rukhadze says Mzia's a symbol of resistance.
We need to continue to do our job because our job is very important and maybe more vital than ever. Than before, and we need to keep fighting. And I'd say if Mzia can keep fighting there behind bars, so can we.
The protests go on. Some days small groups converge, on others large crowds return to downtown Tbilisi. The protesters are fewer in number now, but they say they'll continue to make their voices heard despite the risks. For NPR, I'm Robin Forestier Walker in Tbilisi, Georgia.
For some American Muslims, seeking mental health care is complicated. Oftentimes, there's a cultural expectation that issues should be resolved within the family or through an imam. But now, there's an effort to destigmatize therapy and to make it more easily accessible. From member station WDET in Detroit, Nargis Rahman reports.
Sabrina Ali is a stay-at-home mother and former teacher. She grew up in a South Asian home in Canton, a multicultural suburb of Detroit. And she learned from a young age that she couldn't talk about all her problems with her immigrant parents.
They just came from a totally different world. And for them, it was like, well, what do you have to be depressed about? Like, you're 13. You know, you have a good home. You have a good family. Like, you have food on the table.
And they said she just needed to pray more.
You need to be more religious, essentially, quote unquote, whatever that meant to them.
Ali says over the years, when she felt distressed, she did pray. But one day, after moving out and living on her own, she started having recurring nightmares. That's when she decided it was time to do something more. Go to counseling.
Maybe God is testing me, but even my decision, the path towards making the decision to seek professional help, I think in a way was also a test. What is the saying? Trust in God, but tie your camel, right?
So she started going to a free counseling program at her school, and it helped. For many young Muslims, it's a private entryway to seek counseling services without having to tell your parents.
25 years ago, I realized in our community that people come to us for advice.
Imam Muhammad Majid is the resident scholar of the Al-Dulis Area Muslim Society, or Adams Center.
Sometimes they ask for us to pray for them, and we do provide that spiritual support. But I realize that some of them really might be suffering from mental health issues, and they need somebody to help them.
Many American Muslims have grown up learning that going to therapy is shameful and problems should be kept private. So when there is conflict, they usually go to an imam first for advice. To bridge this gap, Adams Center opened a mental health program about 13 years ago.
When you tell them this is a partnership between me and a mental health provider, both of us are going to help you, they feel relief.
To have the mental health services there is a major pro because it's all kind of built in. It's within the same institution that they're already attending and that they trust.
This is Rania Awad. She's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine and the co-founder of Madistan, a holistic mental health clinic. Awad says her research shows that many American Muslims want mosques to have mental health centers, while others want counseling services in a standalone space for more privacy. Along with therapy provided by a Muslim therapist, in some cases, she says people can request Islamic psychology, the integration of faith into therapy. Take, for example, a patient who has obsessive-compulsive disorder. Islamic psychology might include learning about Islamic regulations for wudu or ablutions as a way to cope with religious compulsions.
How much time and how many limits of how much to wash, how many times to pray or redo your prayers.
And providers can point to a hadith or a teaching of the Prophet Muhammad.
And bringing in, well, here's the hadith of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam that says, no more than three washings in wudu.
This concept of having therapists placed inside the mosque is gaining traction. Last year, the Islamic Center of Detroit began offering mental health services through a new program called the My Mental Wellness Clinic. Danish Hassan is its health director.
We're gathered here today to celebrate a vital initiative that has the power to transform lives in our community, the launch of our new mental health clinic.
Hassan says the clinic hopes to remove barriers and normalize taking care of one's well-being.
The idea with this project is to be visible, to be present, to be accessible and affordable for those that we serve.
As more people seek therapy, Muslim providers are finding new ways to meet people where they're at. For NPR News, I'm Nargis Rahman in Detroit.
Canadian musician Eve Jarvis recently released a deluxe version of his critically acclaimed album, All Cylinders. The album won this year's coveted Polaris Prize, awarded to the best Canadian album of the year. Jarvis was the only person featured on the album. He produced it, wrote it, and he played every single instrument. And we recently caught up with him.
Moon, keep on shining.
My journey for this record was like trying to write songs, trying to make arrangements, trying to make hooks. But usually I'm thinking more symbolically, and like I'm thinking in terms of like light and... That's kind of what started it and what drove it. Thematically, like metal, and light on metal and iridescent quality that I was trying to capture.
I rush to reach you before it's too late, firing all cylinders of this V8.
The music that was interesting me when I made the record was very much about storytelling, and it was very character driven, and I was just listening to people that were like taking me on a ride, like thematically, that was exciting to me. That was like a new frontier.
Sometimes you need to be. Reserve us the best two seats.
Gold Filigree is one of the first tracks I recorded when the album was really coming together. It came out of just a patchwork of percussion, as a lot of my stuff does, but I love to start with percussion.
She had on gold filigree.
Phrase gold filigree in my head, yeah, just this metal work. I think it was just completely emblematic of what I'm trying to do musically, and so it became the imagery of the song, and I think broadly the imagery of the record, and just sonically it's got this sheen.
My friends all say, better go get myself set straight before that clock runs out. Better stop messing about.
Man in his pomp. I took it out of the Bible. It was somewhere in scripture. And I was like, that sounds like a good song. The song is about how degenerate the art life is. And just at all levels. It's like, don't let anybody tell you otherwise. And I say it in the song. I say, that's me. Is such a big part of art. It's very much like being a child. I feel like there's, you know, so many great aspects of that. But then also it's like I feel very detached from polite society, let's say. And Man in His Pomp is literally about that.
Everything I say, take it with a grain. Ever since the start, I've been preaching hard.
My favorite one is With a Grain. It's like the first and last thing I did for the record. So it's like the drums were recorded. I was like in Montreal, back in Montreal, and I was like, I know that I'm making this record. I don't know what I'm making. I don't have songs, whatever. And I went into my friend's studio and just recorded drums, added some stuff to that, and sat on it for like basically 2 years and would just pile things on and then erase it all and started with the bass and then the guitars. I was experimenting with my tone, trying to make it sound like violin.
You dark of night, you bet your life. Look at all in your carousel.
Just always working from that drum recording. And the one day that it clicked was like, it's just what it's all about for me.
That was singer, songwriter, and producer Eve Jarvis. His album All Cylinders is out now. And you've been listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll do it again tomorrow.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is coming up next. Also an NPR News update. Support for NPR comes from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And support comes from you, the listeners of KQED. Let's go to the San Mateo Bridge, get a traffic check. Joe Salvatore.
Yeah, Beth, this is on the westbound section of the San Mateo Bridge, right before mid-span. It's a solo crash. It's in the center divide. The fire crews, though, are blocking the two left lanes. This has traffic backed up all the way to a Clawitter Road. And a crash in Sunol, southbound 680, right at Highway 84. Three vehicles involved here, blocking the two middle lanes. Joe Salvatore for KQED.
Well, thank you, Joe. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that.
Would you give up your chance to rule a country for love?
Girls are told from birth. We watch Disney movies. We're told that there's no greater thing than being a princess. But what is the actual reality of that?
Author and journalist Rebecca Armitage on how covering the British royal family helped inspire the heart of her debut novel, The Heir Apparent. I'm Miles Parks. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's a look ahead to tomorrow's program at 5 o'clock here on KQED News. I'm Beth Heisinger for Sandy Althaus, and this week in our political breakdown newsletter, Guy Marzorati looks at how Democrats are working to make health care a defining issue in next year's midterms, all the way down to the candidates they recruit. Check out Political Breakdown's newsletter at KQED.org. This is KQED San Francisco.